Coming up, we get Nikakis Duncan and Joel Smith talking NBA and NFL. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. We got an amazing special guest today. Newest hire at Yahoo Sports, Nikakis Duncan. Nikakis, how you doing, man?
I am doing well. Happy to be here. Also happy just to be underneath the Yahoo Sports umbrella overall. Just really excited to get going. Like, obviously, also W playoffs happening right now. NBA season right around the corner. We got preseason hoops this weekend. So it's all coming fast, but just amped and excited to talk some hoop, man.
It's all happening right now. You just released your first episode of the Dunker Spot under the Yahoo Sports umbrella with Steve this week, covering the W and previewing the NBA season. We're going to do some more NBA preview today, starting out with the latest news, Nikakis. Jonathan Kuminga, the saga is over for now. For now, yeah. After signing a two-year, $48.5 million team option. 3 months of all this just for him to get an extra $3.5 million after the Warriors initially offered $2.45 back in July. Well, I mean, here we are, though, Nikakis. He is officially signed, and the Warriors at this point now, they're bringing in all their guys, Al Horford, Gary Payton, Seth Curry, De'Anthony Melton. They're signing everybody now. Better late than never, I suppose, but boy, the saga is over for now.
This is like my broader take on this is like restricted free agency is just a scam. And I've been saying this for years and we don't have time to get into that on this pod. But as for the Kuminga of it all, I just don't understand, like in a literal sense I do, but I don't understand how we got here. It seems very clear that we've seen in multiple high leverage moments across the past few seasons, Steve Kerr doesn't really trust Jonathan Kuminga. And I think if you are in a situation where you clearly do not trust the young guy and you are still trying to win while Steph Curry is incredible and while Draymond Green can still wall off the other side of the court, and now you add Jimmy Butler to this, to me, it just makes sense to see what you could get for Jonathan Kuminga and to round out this core, to make this push around Steph Curry and then kind of reconfigure from there. And instead, it's been this weird tightrope to where we still need the drives and the overall athleticism that Jonathan Kuminga brings. You want him to lock in more defensively. That kind of comes in spurts. He hasn't really hit those notes the way that you want him to, but you kind of need him, but you don't really want to need him. And Jonathan Kuminga naturally frustrated by the whole ordeal. He wants to play. He wants the ball in his hands. You know, as awkward as the contract is, it's still a team option. The Warriors didn't budge on that front. And the early wording from Shams is that they're still going to try to look at trade stuff once he's eligible to be traded in January. So as you mentioned, it's solved for now. Like, I don't want to completely dismiss that as a lot of money that Jonathan Kuminga is still getting. That's a lot of money to add to a young man's bank account. But in terms of the basketball opportunity, there's no way he feels comfortable with the situation. Like, there is nothing that signals, yeah, Jonathan Kuminga, this is going to be your second unit when we get to some of the staggering. Or here's our plan to make sure you now get to run 11 pick and rolls per game, as low as the numbers that sounds, but like we're going to ramp up your own ball usage. Like, no, you're about to have a full season with Jimmy Butler now. Draymond Green is still there. You're still going to run a lot of the high initiation stuff through him. Stephen Curry is still there. At best, he's going to be fourth in the pecking order. And that's before getting into some of these vets that just round out better with how Steph and the Warriors ultimately want to play.
Horford included, Nikakis. They're going to run DHOs through him too.
Yeah. So it's just like, there is a world in the basketball sense to where Jonathan Kuminga buys into being more cutter, opens up the transition stuff, attacks second side. Like, there are basketball arguments to make that it can work, but just kind of zooming out with the entire situation, like, the investment is not there. The overall belief is not there. I think with some of the flaws that Jonathan Kuminga still has in his game, some of those, you know, some of the lack of trust is justified to a sense, but you have to commit one way or the other. Like, give him the deal and let him know, okay, you are secure here. Here's our plan for you. Or finally pull the plug on this, trade him, get some vets in the room, and make your final push. I don't like this middle ground.
I don't like it either, but I think from their perspective, okay, so first, I just want to look at what you said about like the rotation aspect, because when you look at the potential Warriors starting five, the word is that Horford is likely to start. So that means the starting five could be Horford, Draymond, Jimmy Butler, Steph, and then the fifth, probably Buddy Hield. Maybe it's a shooter. Maybe it's Pods again as another creator. There's different players you can plug in there, but I can't imagine it would be Kuminga. So Kuminga, it's probably not. And so Kuminga off the bench with, you know, Gary Payton, Moses Moody, Pods, Trace Jackson Davis, whoever, Santos, Melton, depending on how they want to play small, if they're playing, you know, with Kuminga as a small five, as a backup, some Horford Kuminga lineups. There's a lot of different configurations. The Warriors are deep with, like, good, solid, talented players. It's just they don't have that other star, which I think gets to your other point here. The reason why they didn't do like Malik Monk sign and trades or a sign and trade with the Suns is because their ownership, A, they love Kuminga. They want to try to make it work with Kuminga. But B, if they are going to trade Kuminga, they want to go out and get a star. They want to go get a guy that they can bring in and feel like this dramatically increases our championship odds, not Malik Monk. And so I think like with this, the reason why this is only, you know, the saga is over for now until January 15th when he's eligible to be traded. At that point, Nikias, I would be shocked if this becomes anything but who are they going to trade Kuminga for? I just don't see why after 4 years it's suddenly going to be like, okay, great, I will be your Sean Marion, Steve Kerr. I don't think it's going to be that all of a sudden. I think it's going to be more frustration, more just lack of natural fit because he's not a great shooter. He's not a very aware player defensively. He doesn't bring consistent defensive effort as well. He doesn't give the things that the team needs, which is why for him, as you said, to his point, he sees himself as more of an on-ball guy and he wants to grow in that role. So, you know, go get traded to a middling or below-average team without any hopes of contending, and maybe you do grow into that there. It's just a misfit with the Warriors, but I think they're just waiting for the chance to package Kuminga with other guys in January or February for a star.
And, like, that the logic itself makes sense, but, again, you see what's happened. Other teams see that you don't really trust the dude in high leverage moments. So, like, what? Who's going to be the team that's willing to give up the star in a Kuminga thing? Like, barring someone doing some unbelievable strong arming, like, obviously, there's always going to be rumblings around Giannis, for a quick example. But, like, unless insert star name here is like, I want to go to the Warriors, nobody else, I will retire if not, or something egregious to that degree, like, what incentive do teams have to give a star for Jonathan Kuminga? Like, even if you believe in him, the Warriors have shown that they don't. And so it's like, okay, we can get him lower because we know you don't agree. You don't believe. Like, it's
it feels delusional is what it feels like to me with the Warriors. Like the idea of this happening, especially Giannis in particular, because even if Giannis said in January or February, I want to be traded to the Warriors and only the Warriors. If you're the Bucks, you're like, well, they're going to give us three firsts, three swaps, a second, Pods, Moody, Kuminga, Hield to get to your number financially. You could probably do better than that if Giannis is on the table in the summer. So if you're the Bucks, it's not to the benefit of your future if you were to take that package, unless they happen to be extremely high on Kuminga or extremely high on Pods. To me, I think the most likely trade targets for the Warriors would be they would dream about LeBron, but that's likely not happening. Lauri Markkanen feels more realistic.
Yeah,
Zion. You know, as if he's able to stay a little bit healthy, but if he does stay healthy and looks good, maybe the Pelicans decide to keep him.
Yeah, like Friday trade. Yeah.
LaMelo Ball, another one. LaMelo maybe with the Hornets. New ownership, new front office there. You know, you've missed on him before. That's, maybe now you go have your chance to go get him.
They had their chance.
They did. They did what they did. And they whiffed. But the point is that like with Kuminga at $23.3 million plus Moody plus Hield, they can get to $44 million pretty easily, and that's not factoring in Pods and other guys that could add to get to $50 million or even just Kuminga alone in the $20 million range. I think ultimately that's where this is going to end up. And, you know, we'll see come January. Maybe things change. But ultimately, I still look at this Warriors roster and, you know, they add Seth Curry. They bring back Melton. You know, I feel like this team, there's eight guys that are 6'5 or under. Steph, Seth, Pods, Heald, Moody, Melton, Peyton, and Richard. They're all under 6'5. I feel like this team is too small, Nikias. Do you sense, is that one of your concerns with this Warriors roster at all?
Like a little bit, but I also feel like because they have so many of those guys, like they do have a level of lineup. I don't know if lineup versatility is the right word to use in this comparison, but like they have a lot of different guys that can kind of slide in. So if you're worried about one guy, they can just kind of hockey line sub it.
Sure.
And kind of work around it that way. And I think ultimately, if you're able to counter some of your size issues with, we move the ball so incredibly well, we cut well, we screen well, we can just kind of stay ahead of it. The rebounding isn't going to hurt as much if we're able to fly around and force turnovers defensively like we saw for a large portion of last season. If we're super efficient offensively, we're not worried about getting crushed. You know, we're not worried about not getting offensive rebounds because we're scoring and stuff like that. So, like, it's not like a red alert type concern for me. It's something I'm keeping an eye on. Like, for me, it's more just general health and age, particularly with the front line. Like, Jimmy generally misses time. Draymond is less missing time and more, you know, he's hurt, but he's going to play through it because he's tough. And then obviously Al Horford, there's going to be a level of maintenance, I would imagine, with him. And so it's going to be more so that what is going to be their record once they get to the postseason. Because I think even if they win like 45 games this year, if their core 7 or 8 are healthy, they're going to feel like they can beat anyone, especially if there's the synergy that's kind of been built throughout the year. So for me, it's just more so, can you be healthy enough to the regular season to where you don't have, you're not entering in at like 9th and you got 2 play-in games and then you got to face the Thunder or the Nuggets or something in the first round. They just kind of got to get there. So that's probably more of my thing than like the general size. I think the speed and the overall IQ around a lot of that core can kind of offset some of that.
They're going to have to trade Kuminga. To me, I think that's what's going to end up happening. They're going to have to trade Kuminga. It's just a matter of what they get in return. All right, let's move on to our Atlantic Division series. This is the last of the 6 in our division preview series here, Nikias. We're going to talk about the Knicks, Celtics, Raptors, Nets, and Sixers today. Let's start off with the New York Knicks. This offseason, the Knicks added Jordan Clarkson, Gershon Yabusele, and, of course, hire Mike Brown as their head coach. They lose Precious Achiuwa. Their team now, Nikias, you look at their rotation, likely starting 5, Kat, OG Anunoby, Josh Hart, Mikal Bridges, Jalen Brunson. The rotation behind that, with Yabusele being added, who was really good for the Sixers last year, you know, Jordan Clarkson as a spark plug, Deuce McBride, Mitchell Robinson hopefully staying healthy. Mm-hmm. The team looks good on paper. The big question is, what is this offensive system going to look like based off of everything Mike Brown talked about at Media Day? He had quotes about how he wants Brunson to get easy shots. He said, touch the paint and spray for a catch and shoot 3. He talked about Karl Anthony Towns. We're going to move him around a lot. So they want to get Kat in more creative spaces. What are some things you want to see from this Knicks offense this season to feel confident in their chances as a contender?
I think for me, like, general pace is going to be the first thing I look at. More than what they're running, how quickly are they getting the ball up court? Because Jalen Brunson can be methodical, which obviously isn't a bad thing when you can score that efficiently, draw fouls as well as he does. He can kind of bend the game to his will. So I don't want them to lose that, particularly late in games. But through the first 3.5 quarters or so, just what is the general pace? How quickly are they getting into their offense? And then from there, I would like to see Kat moved around. Like, I think in terms of pure passing talent, he's one of the best passing big men that we have in the league. Like, for me, it's more what types of passes are you trying to make? The overhead hook always kind of gets me with some of the tight window throws that Kat has. But just in terms of I have ball, I see opening, I can hit it, Kat can do that. And so if we get more elbow touches, or even if it's just like more delay stuff and letting them make more handoff decisions early in the offense, I think that's an easy way to keep him involved without having to like funnel 18, 19, 20 shots to him. You just want to make sure that he is a presence on virtually every possession. Like, the spacing threat is going to be there. But if you have the ball in his hands and now he can fake a handoff and drive sometimes, or we flow early handoff, he space, he now gets across, you know, gets a cross screen or something. Now you're getting them a post touch in the floor of the offense. Like, I think Mike Brown is good enough and creative enough to get Kat those kind of looks to where defenses can't key in on him. And if you can't key in on him, it's more difficult to key in on Jalen Brunson. And then you're unlocking some of the cutting from Josh Hart. We know how he's going to be defended at the three-point line, but really smart setting pin-in screens and flare screens. He'll cut late and get openings that way. OG Anunoby can shoot the ball. Mikal Bridges can shoot the ball, can also attack closeouts and get into the middie. So I think if you're able to use Cat as that skeleton key and move him around and keep him involved, I think that's how you take pressure off of everyone else. That's how you get to more of the catch and shoot opportunities for Jalen Brunson. I think just in general, if you're able to lighten the on ball role for him earlier in games, it makes him even more effective. As Mike Brown said during media day, the ball's going to be in his hands late in games. He should be more effective and a little bit fresher if you're able to involve everyone else and kind of use Cat as an avenue to unlock that.
I mean, I think everything you said is spot on, and I'm pretty optimistic about Mike Brown as their hire because of what he did with the Kings, especially that first year with the Lightning Beam Kings. A lot of the stuff they ran for Sabonis, I hope we see installed for Cat. Of course, Cat is more dynamic because of his ability to attack off the dribble, because of his elite three-point shooting ability. He can do a bit more than Sabonis can. He's just a better overall player. Sabonis is very good, but Cat can be great. And I think with that creativity moving him around, that does indicate we'll see more half-court diversity from this offense. And I think you're right, though. First thing you said, the pace. Like, will this team play a bit faster as well over the course of games is something of interest to me. And I think, you know, we're talking about the starters, but, you know, the key figures in the team. But that's something that can also help out a Deuce McBride, a Jordan Clarkson. Like, some of these guys who are coming off the bench, I think they can play with pace as well. And as they are integrated into games, I think that's important. And also, I think, you know, one other factor we saw last season, Thibodeau, not until the playoffs, he barely at all ran two bigs. And I know Mitchell Robinson missed most of the entire season, but he didn't do it with Huck Porty. He didn't do it with Jericho Sims plus Cat over the course of the year. It really wasn't until the playoffs, even after Mitchell Robinson returned end of the season, that we saw two bigs. I wonder how much we'll see two bigs from the Knicks over the course of the regular season as well, because that was supremely a factor for them come postseason time.
Yeah, like I think that should be a part of the toolkit for Mike Brown for sure. And I think that kind of leads into the other end. And what does Mike Brown want to do defensively? What does he want to do with the bigs? Is this going to be more activity-based? We want Cat at the level. When Mitchell Robinson's in, we want him at the level. Is it going to be more, let's have y'all in the drop, we're going to trust the navigation up top? Is it going to be, we want the bigs in the drop, we want the navigation up top, but we're going to be more aggressive as a help team to kind of plug gaps? Like, I'm curious to see, like, what buttons Mike Brown presses on that front. I think, if I remember correctly, some of the reporting that came out after the Knicks were eventually eliminated was frustration with Cat within the defensive scheme, to where he has been given a directive and sometimes he's just not doing that. And that had the other four like, hey, we can't be on the same page if you have the call and you're doing something else and we don't know that you're doing something else. And so for me, obviously, there is the question of what coverage is Cat going to be in and how effective he's going to be on a very basic level. Is Cat going to attempt what he is being told to do? Because I think if you can get that level of consistency there, it helps everyone else. And then from there, which version of Mikal Bridges do you get defensively? Will you see more of the all defense level him, or is he just going to be solid? Because that kind of dings the rest of the defense if he's only solid defensively.
Is that secretly the most important factor for the Knicks to be the favorite in the East?
I would say so, yeah. Like, I think if you can get Cat to a level of consistent competence on that end, because we have seen in different spots, he can do it. He's mobile enough, especially if you're talking about him just being at the level of screens and kind of using the hand activity. He can be, so he's not all defense level, but he can be solid enough. And the Knicks, with how they built the rest of this roster, whether it is, you know, Cat at the four alongside Mitchell Robinson, as you were alluding to, or even him at the five, they have, in theory, an infrastructure to where if you're playing more aggressive with him, we can plug gaps. We can have Mikal Bridges on the back line blowing stuff up or just helping at the nail. We can have OG Anunoby, who is just an all-defense caliber guy, fly around and muck stuff up. And so if Cat just does his job consistently, they should be a very good unit on that end. Get stops. You all get, you know, to help the pace issue offensively. We're forcing turnovers. We're getting stops. We can just flow into early offense. We don't have to think too hard and run sets. We can just kind of flow. And I know Mike Brown is going to do his job to implement just your general flow things. This is how we want to space. This is when we want to cut. This is when we want to clear space and things like that. So if they get the Cat portion together defensively, all bets are off of how good this team can be.
Who would you pick to go to the finals in the East right now today?
Ooh. Like, I feel like it should be the Knicks. Like, I think they have the most talent. as of October 1st, before we do our own season previews and things over at the Dunker Spot, I'd probably say the Knicks. Like, that should be the answer. You have the top end talent, you have the depth, you have the wing depth in particular. I feel good about Mike Brown as a head coach on both ends. It should be the Knicks.
I think it should be the Knicks too. I'm not sure I'll end up picking the Knicks, but it should be the Knicks. And I think I'll pick the Knicks, but I'm not 100% certain there. And two of the reasons why I'm not 100% totally certain are, A, the Cavs are really, really, really good. But B, there's still some, you know, X factor teams within the Eastern Conference that I think are still worth considering. And one of those teams being the Philadelphia 76ers. I can't completely quit the Sixers this offseason. Of course, they lose Gershon Yabusele. They add Trendon Watford. They drafted VJ Edgecombe in the lottery and Jani Broome in the second round. On paper, the Sixers, you know, Embiid in images and photos posted on, you know, Sixers, you know, social media accounts looks leaner.
Looks good.
I've heard he looks good as well from people I've talked to in and around the team that he had a very successful summer for his body. So I think for Philly, with Embiid and, you know, maybe a bounce back year for Paul George, Tyrese Maxey taking more steps forward, and Jared McCain once he comes back from his thumb injury, and they have depth, they have guys like VJ Edgecombe who could be really good as rookies. So I think with Philadelphia, there's a they're not the favorite, but there's an outside shot if this is the year Embiid is healthy come April, May, June. He has the pieces to get him healthy in April. He has the pieces to get him to the finish line, considering all the other talent on the roster. But am I just delusional to even hold on to the hope of the Sixers as a finals contender, Nikias? Or, you know, am I right to still feel there's still a chance? There's still a chance.
I wouldn't say delusional. Because funny enough, I had like a similar thought. I was on with Zach Lowe over the offseason.
I have been told I am delusional many times before, so it's good to hear that I'm not being delusional here.
I wouldn't say delusional. I was talking with Zach when I hopped on his pod earlier in the summer, and I was like, you know, I can still see the high end of the Sixers, and he's very much on the other side. Like, you just can't have faith in this team because of the health and everything else, and I think that's fair. And so I wouldn't say delusional because I can see if everything hits, this is the high end talent that they have, and Joel Embiid is a world destroyer when he's healthy. And so I see it. I think for me, one, health is just going to be the big thing with this Sixers group. And then even with that, I kind of look at the four room now with Philly, and I just kind of wonder, like, who really settles in there? Like, is that going to be Paul George kind of by default if you're going to start VJ Edgecombe or if you're going to start Kelly Oubre to kind of complete the forward room there? Like, I do just kind of wonder what that part's going to look like. Like, as someone that is like a big Trendon Watford fan and stuff, like, I don't know what kind of trust he's going to garner in all seriousness. Like, I would just like to see him have the shot. Just watching him play, I think he is good, and I think he can earn his way there. And like, maybe he has the Yabusele year from last year to where he does get that rotation time. It's like, oh, right, this is a guy that can put the ball on the floor a little bit, can shoot a little bit, can defend a little bit, has athleticism, etc. So like, if the four spot is answered, I feel better about Philly. To your point, like, Tyrese Maxey, as weird as his season was, I think he was very good, but the context around him was just so odd with all the injuries and things. I think it was good that he was able to get some experience on the floor without Embiid. And I think him seeing more defensive attention and having to make earlier and quicker decisions on the ball when he got second defenders, I think that growth and I think that experience should be good for him. I think that should help enhance the Maxey and Embiid two-man game, whether that's pick and roll or handoffs. Maxey quietly getting better as a foul drawer. We know he's fast and can get into the paint whenever he wants to, but like, seeing some of the deceleration stuff, seeing him seeking out limbs on some of his drives, that should all help him. And so there's absolutely a world to where he becomes even more of a force offensively. Joel Embiid draws the attention that he does. Any sort of offensive bounce back from Paul George last year, because quietly, I feel like he was pretty darn good defensively. So I don't think we talk about it because
what do you think was behind his offensive struggles, Paul George, that is?
I honestly can't call it, which is a great podcast answer, but like, I don't want to toss BS on the pod. I honestly don't know, because it didn't feel like anything really changed for like the jumper form or anything like that. Like, I wonder if it's just general getting used to when he gets his touches and where he's getting them, and that, if that affected the rhythm.
Lower volume, and he never really last year, of course, definitely far, far less touches.
Yeah, so like maybe that's it. And then when he did have his touches, it felt like he was more playmaker focused, which I thought he did a pretty good job of that as well. And so like maybe I feel like it's just a rhythm deal, at least off the top of my head. Like I'd like to dig in more and have a better answer next time we talk about this, but it felt more rhythm to me. But like I know he can shoot. I know he can get to his own spots. Like I kind of questioned like heading into the year, what exactly is the rim pressure for Paul George going to look like? Because he's not as explosive off the bounce as he once was. But he can kind of get to his jumper whenever he wants to. And I trust his level of shooting. So if that bounces back, even if he's not a high rim pressure free throw rate guy, he's still going to be a valuable offensive piece. And if you are banking on Joel Embiid draws two on the block, Tyrese Maxey is drawing two more and it's just better, Paul George should have more tilted defenses to attack. And I think he is still well equipped to take advantage of those opportunities.
One of the thoughts I've had with the Sixers this year is VJ Edgecombe is the most important rookie in the NBA. Cooper Flagg's the best rookie, but VJ Edgecombe is the most important rookie because of the impact he could have on the Sixers in the wide open Eastern Conference. When you think about a guy who is a very good spot-up shooter, who is going to be one of the better athletes in the NBA, even as a rookie, for downhill attacking, transition, rim runs, like he can get ahead of the defense, the versatility he has on the defensive end of the floor as well. He's going to have a bunch of highlight blocks from behind and steals, sparking transition opportunities. He's a playmaker. That's what Edgecombe is. And I think if he can provide some of those things for the Sixers, whether it's as a starter or coming off the bench, finishing games, regardless of the volume of his role, if it's 20 minutes or 30 minutes, Edgecombe, I think, is the X factor on this team. Similar in the ways that McCain last year prior to the injury, Maxey prior to him becoming an all-star caliber player, these young guys that help boost the chances of a team making a deep run, supporting the star player. Think about the Warriors with all the whiffs they've had in the draft and how different the complexion of that team would look if they had hit on any of those draft picks. Same thing with the Sixers, but the opposite. It seems like McCain was a hit. Maxey was an absolute hit. If VJ Edgecombe is also a hit, this team suddenly takes on a different look with the lineups that they can play, the style that they can play, and the support Embiid has, where there's just less pressure on him to have to do everything. And also just the less pressure there'd be on Paul George. For Paul George to have to defend the opponent's best player, sometimes he can relax if VJ Edgecombe is out there being a dog. And so with Edgecombe this year, and I look at the state of the Eastern Conference, the East does suck. And ultimately, I'm not ruling out Philly. I don't think they belong in the contender category, but they're really, really, really close. And there's like very simple questions they can answer early in the year for them to very clearly be in that category and also be one of the teams that have a better chance in the East. But ultimately, Nikias, like, we might fall in love with Philly in October, November, December, and January, and then the annual Embiid injury happens. And ultimately, like, unless he stays healthy, everything else doesn't matter for this season. It would just matter for the future of the Sixers. And I think that's where, if I'm a Philly fan, obviously I want to win a championship with Joel Embiid. Like, that's obvious. I want to win a title, period. But if things do sour around Embiid, I still feel like there's enough good things for the Sixers team that I still feel pretty good about their future.
Yeah, like I think this is kind of the pivot season of sorts. Like to your overall point, like I think it's fair to put Philly in the dark horse category. If things go right, I don't know how many teams in the East have a higher ceiling than Philly, like within that class of teams. If you're talking about the if things go right group, that is Philly. Do we put Milwaukee in that group since there's just a lot of uncertainty about like what the guard room is going to be, what version of Kyle Kuzma, et cetera. So like Philly, Milwaukee, if you want to put, I've struggled to where like I would put Atlanta or Orlando. I'm just high on both of those teams, but they haven't proven it yet. So
on
I guess
the
they kind of have to be there.
You know, I think on the rise, there's a chance, you know, Orlando could be a contender, but on the rise.
Yeah. So like, if we're not putting them there, like Philly and Milwaukee, like I think you can make a case for Philly. I would probably lean Milwaukee just because I just have more faith in, like, Giannis is just, I don't want to call him underrated because I think we all recognize him as like universally a top three player in the league, but it does still feel like he kind of goes underappreciated at the very least. And so like, I'll probably have Milwaukee over Philly within that group. But I think, again, you can make a strong case for Philly being that. I will just say to your VJ Edgecombe point, one, just loved watching him in Summer League. He seems ready, as that was kind of like my on-court introduction to him at the very least. But if a rookie, just generally, if a rookie is your X factor for the season, I do feel a little squeamish about that. And that's where, like, I can't quite make the full Philly push if I am banking on VJ has to hit as a rookie. Like, that's unfair pressure, not to you directly, but like, I feel like that's unfair pressure for a rookie in general to kind of have to be the skeleton key to unlock the ceiling of a team. Like, I want this to be Tyrese Maxey improves, Paul George is back, Joel Embiid is back, Kelly Oubre is good, VJ Edgecombe is the bonus that takes them over versus he might have to be the answer at the three if Paul George is the four. And he has to take on these on-ball assignments and he has to shoot well enough to where defenses care about him. And he has to be like, that's where I'm just like, ooh, if I have to rely on that, I don't want to put my egg in that basket.
I think that's a completely fair framing for VJ Edgecombe. He's the bonus. And if he's the bonus, that changes things for the Sixers this year with what they could be, especially if they get positive answers to everything else that you outlined. And we'll be right back after this break. Talk about the Celtics, who this offseason had, you know, they're the real first casualty of the new second apron penalties. They lose Drew Holiday, Kristaps Porzingis, Al Horford, and Luke Kornet, just decimated front court. They add Anthony Simons, Chris Boucher, Joss Minot. They drafted Hugo Gonzalez, Amari Williams, and Max Scholga in the second round. Their rotation this year, Nekias, you know, no Jason Tatum. The team just looks completely different with him as a guy that maybe he won't return later in the season. But, you know, you'll have Jaylen Brown out there, Peyton Pritchard, Derek White. But that center rotation, Xavier Tillman, Kata, Boucher, Garza, if there's any hope for the Celtics to be really competitive this year, I think one of those guys or multiple of those guys have to be unexpectedly good this season for Boston. What is your level of trust in the Celtics rotation? And please tell me why it's not the worst center rotation in the entire NBA.
I am so glad that you framed the beginning of the Boston conversation this way, because I was thinking about, you know, just getting my notes and stuff together for the pod. I was like, I feel like I'm going to do the Nekias thing and we're going to go to Boston. And the first thing I want to talk about is Xavier Tillman. And so I'm glad that we started here. So I actually can just naturally talk about Xavier Tillman, because going through Boston Media Day things, he was actually, well, technically number two on the list, because Jason Tatum just being on the court right now is absurd. And I'll just say quickly, I love people that love basketball as much as Jason Tatum does. For whatever you want to say about him, you know, for like non-Celtic fans and stuff like that, you're not obligated to root for anyone. That man is about basketball. And it is hard not to respect that, even if you don't like him because of the uniform that he wears or whatever else. Like, I think that is dope. I want him to come back fully healthy. Like, ideally, we just see him at the start of 26-27. But if he does make the push and he's back in March or April or something, kudos to him. But I love how much he loves hoop. But back to this Boston front court. I think heading into the season, it is more than fair to have questions about what their front line is going to be, especially within the context of all of the front court talent and front court versatility that they lost. However, circling back to Xavier Tillman, looks better. Talked about how much better he feels. Talked about his comfort in the three-point shot. Also sprinkling in the nugget that through the early, you know, early camp and stuff like that, Boston is playing faster, and that really intrigues me. Like, this is media day, so everyone wants to play faster. They want to defend their yada yada. But if this is going to be a more up-tempo group, that leads me to believe this is going to be a more pick-and-roll heavy group, especially with Jason Tatum out. And I think they do kind of have the horses for that if they're going to do that. If they're going to play faster, they have athletes on the roster still. You have Anthony Simon that can run a ball screen, can get into pull-ups. You have Peyton Pritchard that can run ball screens and get into pull-ups and can get into the paint as well. Jaylen Brown's comfortable on the ball. Derek White's comfortable on the ball. And you look in the room, like, Luka's a really good screener. We got to see where the defense is going to land. But if you talk about general pick-and-roll threat, it's not going to be a top-tier name, but he can execute that for you. Xavier Tillman's one heck of a screener. And if he is going to knock down shots, he's not going to be guarded. He's going to have to prove that. But he's going to be taking stuff in rhythm, and they can still flow into some of their handoff triggers and things like that when he is being ignored off the ball. There's still a level of flow that the Celtics offense can get into. Nemias Kata, incredible screener. Have written about his screens, for that matter, when I was doing Screen Time at some other outlets. And so, like, he can absolutely do that and screen and die. And so there's still going to be an element of spacing. We know Joe Mazzulla is going to prioritize an optimal shot profile. They're going to get threes up. If they're playing with more tempo and you have a level of different looks that you could toss out defensively with the bigs, like, I think if healthy, there isn't a coverage Xavier Tillman can't execute, for example. And you can go activity-based with the other ones if you want to. You still have the outline of a team that at minimum is going to be very difficult to beat. They're going to have math on their side. They can play faster. You just need them to fill roles. Like, the expectation should not be we need Nemias Kata to be as good as Al Horford. The expectation should be, can they screen well enough to get Derrick White openings? Can they screen well enough to get Jaylen Brown, Anthony Simons, Peyton Pritchard openings? I think the answer is a resounding yes on that front. Can they then finish? Xavier Tillman's going to have to finish better than he did last year. Like, last year was just weird. Health stuff, didn't finish, didn't shoot, yada, yada. But, okay, can they finish lobs? Can they finish layups if either of those guards get two on the ball? I feel like they probably can. And so would I rank them as the, like, 12th best big man room in the league? Absolutely not. At least not heading into the year. Can they fill these bite-sized roles? Can they all screen well enough to pry open? Again, Pritchard, Brown, White, etc. I think they can if the shot making's there. Eh.
Nikias, we're very much looking at this in the same way. Because I think I look at the Celtics team and I'm like, not bad. Like, they're going to be tough to beat. They're going to play hard. I think they're going to be fun. I think this is going to be a really fun team to watch. And ultimately, I think for them, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, come middle of February, they're a game or two over 500. Wouldn't shock me one bit at all if they're surprisingly pretty solid. And I think there's, like, no Tatum creates opportunity. Everybody talks about Jaylen Brown. What's he going to do without Jason Tatum? Is he going to put up 37-5? Is he going to have a big year? Everybody talks about Jaylen, but I'm also wondering, what is Derek White going to do with more opportunity, with more on-ball chances? Because you think about when he was in San Antonio, he was not an elite shooter off the catch. He was pretty good off the dribble, getting into his mid-range, running some pick and roll, making the right decision. He hasn't had as many reps in Boston's offense to do that, in part because of the structure of that team and the guys ahead of him. What's Derek White going to look like? Is he going to take another step forward? Does Peyton Pritchard go from sixth man of the year caliber talent to, wait a minute, he can do more with more volume? He's still having success as a starter. Anthony Simons, we've seen this guy go through stretches, especially a couple years ago when Dame was out in Portland. I think it was like a February, March, April stretch where Anthony Simons was putting up Dame-like numbers. And I know I'm picking from a small sample in the second half of a season, but Simons has had some big stretches in his career. And never mind the young guys, Jordan Walsh, Baylor Shireman, what did they do? Sam Hauser with more opportunities, more minutes, more opportunities to shoot off the catch. Shireman coming off the dribble, and Jordan Walsh as well. Will he prove himself as an NBA player? I think the centers can do everything that you outlined. Make the right play, set good screens, hopefully finish well at the rim, and hopefully provide versatile defense. But I'm also really excited to see what some of these non-Jaylen Brown guys do with all the touches and minutes and shots that are going to be available for them. And I'm pretty bullish on some of those guys. And I think ultimately this Celtics team, I think they're going to be good enough that there will be the question come March, if Tatum's healthy, should he come back? I think the team will be in a position that they'll be good enough that it will be appealing for Tatum to return. The only question will be, is he healthy enough at that point? My assessment of Boston entering this season.
Oh, I think that is fair. And, like, I'm very much, like, more positive on Boston, at least right now. Like, once games played, I'm just like, ooh, actually, never mind. I think if we're talking about concern areas, again, you are just missing, as simple as it sounds, you are missing Jason Tatum. And I don't think it's fully understood, like, outside the Boston market, not only how much he does, but how much he unlocks. And I think his versatility defensively. Like, I don't think, look, you know, going through like voting tellers and stuff, like, I don't know how close Jason Tatum has actually been to making an all defense team. But his ability to, I'll be on a point guard so we can just turn all these other things into switches. I'll start this game on a center so we can turn all these things into switches. And him being able to do that, him being able to rebound and jumpstart, like, they are going to absolutely miss that. And I think offensively, especially once you also factor in losing an Al Horford and things like that, I am curious to see, like, non-pick and roll division, what kind of passing team this is going to be. Not necessarily in terms of the volume, but more so when there is an opening, how quickly are they hitting those? Because I think Jason Tatum has gotten really good at diagnosing what defenses want to do and being able to not only punish them with simple reads, but now he's gotten into more manipulation over the last 2-3 years. And I think there is a massive difference between Tatum and Jaylen Brown in that aspect. Like, I think Derek White can handle more of the playmaking, but even that's going to be a little bit different. To your point about his overall shooting, has gotten so much better off the catch. The pull-up itself, he's gotten more comfortable taking them, but in terms of efficiency, that's been pretty streaky during his Boston tenure. And so will he make enough pull-ups to where defenses have to ramp up their coverage enough to unlock some of the playmaking reads that'll make things simple for everyone else? Like, that's going to be a question that I have. And so I do wonder, I guess just generally, like, what's the volume of switches that Boston sees this year? Like, that's kind of been a consistent thing for me anyway. But now without Tatum, do teams feel even more comfortable saying, actually, we are turning all of this into switches and you're going to have to get out the mud? That's going to put onus on the bigs, as we talked about a little bit earlier. Okay, can you punish switches enough, either with scoring, foul drawing, or offensive rebounds, to where that's untenable? Can Derek White, Jaylen Brown score enough in isolation to make switching untenable?
One last thing I'll say about Boston. On BetMGM, they're plus 6,600 to win the NBA Finals. On DraftKings, the DraftKings are plus 8,000. I mean, those are very low odds. I don't think they reflect enough the possibility of a Tatum return. That is one thing I'll say. It's considering how open the East is, I don't think that possibility is reflected enough in those odds. Let's move on to the Toronto Raptors. This offseason, I love their draft. They took Colin Murray-Boyles in the lottery, Elijah Martin, one of my favorite sleepers in the second round. They signed him to a two-way contract. And the rotation this year, it's a weird team, Nikias. Like, this is
weird
roster around Scotty Barnes, Brandon Ingram now in his second season, RJ Barrett, Emmanuel Quickley, Jakob Poeltl, a bunch of young guys off the bench. What are you watching for from the Raptors this season? Number one thing on your mind the first time you turn on a Raptors game in October?
Number one thing for me is going to be trying to figure out what their identity is going to be. Because I look at this Raptors roster and my general thought is they have like 11, maybe 12 guys that I feel like they can give competent NBA minutes on any given night. And I think there is some value in that. But I'm also like, Their defense slanted lineups do not have enough shooting and creation. Their offensively slanted lineups don't have enough defense for me to feel comfortable. So, like, what portion are they going to lean on most? And then from there, how do they find the balance? Because I think you can talk me into, like, I think they were the best defense in the league post-All-Star break. You always have to take post-All-Star break samples with a grain of salt. But you look at what they were actually trying to accomplish. High ball pressure, a lot of activity. Bigs can ramp it up when you need to. They fly around off the ball. And so, like, they have the personnel to continue to do that. As you mentioned, some of their young guys, particularly off the bench, like, I'm excited to see more Jamal Shedd just being in someone's jersey when you've rent for 13 minutes a night, just make life miserable for the opposing ball handler. But, like, Scotty Barnes, before he got hurt, and I've talked about this before, one of my frustrations is when they've had Scotty, like, defending point guards sometimes. It's like, I don't want him chasing guards. I want him defending 3-5 and blowing stuff up. And I think we saw more of that last year. And before going down, I think he was performing, if not at an all defense level, at least well enough to where he deserved to be mentioned in that conversation. And so for me, if they're able to establish a baseline level of defense with Scotty, with Jakob Poeltl, do you get more consistency from RJ Barrett? What level of consistency do you see from Brandon Ingram? Because he has the length. He can defend on-ball, screen navigation, and off-ball awareness is kind of where he gets thing. But, like, if you're able to buy in, that is just a lot of length, 3-5. That's a lot of versatility, 3-5, at least theoretically. If they're going to continue to have the high ball pressure looks, and you can bleed clock, that makes life a little bit easier, in theory, at the very least. Get out in transition. You now have the playmaking of Scottie Barnes, some of the post-ups against smaller players, Jakob Poeltl as a hub to unlock some of the cutting and some of the handoff stuff that simplifies things in theory for Emmanuel Quickly and RJ Barrett, who I need people to be a little bit kinder to RJ Barrett as a basketball player. I'll just sprinkle that in there. And like Brandon Ingram, like Leighton Clark, they now have a guy. You can say, oh, there's 9 seconds. Our initial offense didn't work. Quickly, love all the movement that Darko's
worked. Tell me, why do people need to be kinder to RJ Barrett?
Because I feel like we're just kind of we've kind of pigeonholed him into like the Knicks era RJ. And like, I don't think all of that is unfair because like, again, he does need to be more consistent defensively. This is something that he talked about at Media Day. But he has gotten better as a passer. I think he's been put in better spots since coming to Toronto with where they're starting him, the kind of screens that he's able to receive to kind of get him going to his left. He's gotten more comfortable in the middle of the floor. That's probably been my biggest criticism of RJ's game. Like, no real pull-up midi, no real floater. Like, that has gotten better. He puts a ton of pressure on the rim and can get to the line. Like, I think he's just a solid player.
He's rock solid for sure. I think that's the truth with a lot of their guys. Just rock solid, rock solid, rock solid, rock solid, up and down the board with a lot of them. And I think your point about some of their defensive slanted lineups don't have enough shooting and vice versa with their offensive slanted lineups don't have enough defense. And to me, I think with this team, that is going to be the question for them when it comes to being competitive this year. Is there enough shooting? The answer is probably no to that question. But to me, the Raptors, it's not about being competitive this year. It's about, as you said, finding your identity, finding out who your keepers are, who the guys are that you want to keep long term, and who you want to build with. And I think very clearly their intentions are to build a long-armed, big lineup. When you talk about Scottie Barnes with who he is as a player, acquiring Brandon Ingram, having RJ Barrett still on the roster, and then drafting Colin Murray-Boyles in the lottery. Murray-Boyles, at his size and length, 6'8", 6'9", 7-plus wingspan, a non-shooter. You're adding another non-shooter to the bunch, but he's an elite defensive prospect. With his versatility, the intensity, his awareness on the floor. Like, there's so many times at South Carolina where he's the type of defender where he anticipates passes coming as a drop defender and gets his long arms in the way to deflect passes. And that defense last year was awful overall when he was off the floor. I believe the number was there were 28 points per 100 possessions better defensively with Murray-Boyles on the floor compared to when he was off. Like, that's like the number does reflect his impact defensively with what he can bring. And so very clearly, you know, taking a guy like Elijah Martin out of Florida in the second round, the clear intentions for this team is to be defense first, long armed, play hard, turn it into transition on offense, but you still need shooting. And I think that's where, like, hopefully Ingram can shoot more threes. Hopefully RJ can shoot well. Hopefully Barnes can continue to progress. Hopefully some of these guys can figure it out. Grady Dick, hopefully he can find his way. Did you see he's listed 2 inches taller, Nekias? So what do you think about Grady Dick growing 2 inches?
Well, it fits into the overall Raptors ethos of having the length and the, you know, collective versatility. You're not getting me, bud. You're not getting me. But I think he, in a series, though, like, he is going to be very important to this group. If you talk about the overall shooting questions, like, he should be a part of the answer to that equation. And I think if he's able to hold up better defensively, he can be part of these quote-unquote defensively slanted groups. Because I already trust him, pump fake, 2 dribbles, and get into the pull-up. Like, he's already very good at that. 3-point shooting, and again, within the overall movement that Darko's worked to establish since he's been there, they run really fun stuff offensively. Like, the offensive rating doesn't do justice, in my opinion, to what Toronto is actually working to accomplish in their half-court offense. And so if the shooting does come along, I think that's going to pop more for people that aren't watching Toronto intently. So I've just put that on the radar for the listeners. But if Grady's able to pop, that certainly helps. Like, to the Scottie Barnes piece, like, I am curious to see. Like, him plus Jakob excites me defensively. I also wonder, like, when they're using Jakob as a hub, where is Scotty going to be? Is he going to be weak side corner? Is he going to be strong side corner to kind of occupy defenders? Are they going to have Scotty in the dunker when they kind of invert that? Because obviously, like, when Scotty has it, they're putting Jakob in the dunker spot. But, like, that dynamic is going to be interesting to track as they try to carve out enough of the half-court offense. Because I think the defense, to your point, it should just be really good. Like, I don't think it's going to be best in the league like they were first All-Star break. Again, grains of salt, et cetera. They got a lot of dogs in the room over there. I am going to enjoy watching the Raptors defend this year, I think.
I'm very excited to watch Toronto. I think they're going to be fun. I mean, I think a lot of these teams we've discussed so far today are going to be fun in the Atlantic Division. It's one of the more, you know, 1 through 5 in this group. I'm excited to watch a lot of these teams, and I think that's also true with probably the worst team of this bunch, the Brooklyn Nets, this offseason. This is just a young team with a bunch of fun players that I think have a chance to be really good in the long term. And they had a very busy offseason starting on draft night. They made all of their picks. Yegor Demin, Nolan Traore, Drake Powell, Ben Saraf, Danny Wolf, four of those guys being point guards of different shapes and sizes. And then, of course, they acquire Michael Porter Jr., Haywood Highsmith, Terrence Mann, Kobe Bufkin as well, losing Cam Johnson and Trenton Watford. But ultimately, this Nets team, my big question with them, Nikias, when you look at all the names on paper, is – how are developmental minutes going to be distributed here? Because there's a lot of mouths to feed when it comes to developing the young guys here. There's just a lot of names on the Nets that I think have a chance to be good in the long term.
No, I think that's fair. I think for me with this Brooklyn team, and I hope I get the year correct. I could just like look this up right now. But I want to say it was 2023. The Oklahoma City Thunder were still in their rebuilding phase. But for the first, I want to say, month and a half, 2 months of the season, they were a top 10 defense. And then, you know, trades, we're sitting folks, Shade, come sit over here, et cetera, and they were bad again. And then they kind of ramped it up following. We know what's happened last year, et cetera. My sneaky, like, Nakia slash hot take question for Brooklyn is, like, are they going to be a top 10 defense through, like, December 15th before it all falls apart? Because lowest of keys, like a bounce back season for Nick Claxton would do a lot for them. Oh, yeah. It was a very weird year for him, health-wise, trying to find his way among all the moves he made and things like that. But I am a big fan of everything Nick Claxton can do defensively.
One of the most versatile defenders in the league when he's playing at his best.
He is incredible. He's always been a favorite of mine. And I think in general with Brooklyn, if you were watching them on League Pass last year, we talked a little bit about like high ball pressure with Toronto. This Brooklyn team was legitimately going full court press. Jordy had those guys defending their tails off. Zaire Williams, Jalen Wilson. Like, they were just in the jerseys of folks. Dennis Schroeder, while he was still there, just in the jerseys of folks. And I think you add Terrence Mann. He does not mind extending pressure. We saw it with the Clippers. But in general, he's fine taking on tough defensive matchups. Haywood Highsmith, I think the Heat, while he was still a member of the Heat, announced he's going to be out 6 to 8 weeks, I think, back in early August. I think the timeline should have him back around now. If not before the end of the regular, if not by the start of the regular season, excuse me. So when Haywood's there, like, he also has the reputation of taking on tougher assignments. Miami had him doing a little bit of everything while he was there. But like, I think they do just have a lot of athletic guys that can be super annoying defensively with Nick Claxton on the back line. I think they are really going to bother some people early in the season. I don't have any delusions about them like making a play-in push or making a playoff push, but I think the defense is going to be really good. And then from there, like, just what are we getting from Cam MPJ is kind of where I start with this Brooklyn team. But the defense, I'm super excited about.
Yeah, I think their defense is going to be exciting. As you said, more ball pressure, and they just have a lot of dogs on the team. Even their young guys coming in, I think, like Yegor Demin, he can defend. You know, Danny Wolf is not a good defensive player necessarily as a rookie, but he plays hard. And they have a lot of guys who play hard is my overall point here. And I think Nolan Traore as well, coming off the bench for them, I'd assume, is he able to apply that ball pressure as well with his speed and athleticism and versatility? And can any of these guys pop offensively? Does Demin look like a potential star? Does Nolan Traore put it together offensively and look like, you know, a DeJounte Murray type of player with his speed? Does his shot look better? There's a lot of guys on that Nets offense that of their rookies that there's a chance. You know, does Kobe Bufkin, does he stay healthy for once after, you know, I loved him in the draft out of Michigan. He never put it together in Atlanta, but he was also hurt every single year. He was also behind guys. But, like, can he put it together? There's a lot of these guys on the Nets that I'm excited to see if they have a star that pops. But ultimately, if I'm a Nets fan, I hope we're fun. I hope we're exciting. But boy, I hope we're in the lottery again. I don't want to be in the playoffs by accident, Nikias. That's what, I don't want that this year for the Nets.
Yeah, they're gonna have to tap Jordy on the shoulder. It's gonna have to be. You know what? Since we can go back to Toronto, because like one of the funnier subplots of Raptor games, if you were watching them like post February. Is that, again, that defense spearheaded a lot for them. They're in games, and then the fourth quarter happens, and you don't know what the rotation is going to be. It is, we are subbing out Jakob Poeltl. We are subbing out insert starter that has played well here. And it's just like, okay, Toronto, we see what you're doing. This is funny, but we see what you're doing. I don't know if the Nets are going to have to copy that formula, but it wouldn't surprise me if we see some lineup hijinks at some point, because I think Jordy Fernandez is just a really good coach. Like, you have to be careful about like one season samples and things like that.
He made those kids play last year, man. Like, for a losing situation to play that hard, it does say something.
Yeah. So, like, I am already in on Jordy. And if I end up having to take an L by the end of this season, then I'll do that. But I'm just in on Jordy. I think, again, the defense is going to be very good. I'll put the take out there. I think through December 15th, the Nets are going to have a top 10 defense. And y'all can laugh at me if that doesn't end up being the case. This is going to be an interesting group. The offense, I just don't know where it's going to be because of some of the spacing. There's just the Cam Thomas of it all, took the qualifying offer. Like, quietly, him and Nick Claxton had one of the best pick and roll duels in the NBA last year. But beyond that, you still want more playmaking growth from him. MPJ in a new context, we know how valuable the shooting is going to be, but he is not playing off of Nikola Jokic anymore. So you're not going to have, I don't think, the same quality of catch and shoot opportunities. You're not going to have the same cutting windows. He's going to have to put the ball on the deck a little bit more. I am curious to see what that looks like.
I think with him, you know, you say that, Nikias, I'm not so sure, because there's so many guys on that Nets team, the rookies especially that they drafted, that I think should have the ball in their hands. I want to see Yegor Demin run point. I want to see Nolan Traore. I want to see like Danny Wolfe, 7-foot point guard at times. I want to see these things. I want to see Cam Thomas with the ball in his hands now that he has his new deal. Michael Porter Jr., I don't think he has that. I think he is that off-ball guy. I think he is that cutter. He is that off-ball shooter. I don't think he is an on-ball presence, and maybe he wants to get that opportunity in what will be a non-contending situation this year. But if I'm the Nets, my investment is in some of those young guys and developing them, unless they want to increase the value of Michael Porter Jr. and try to turn him into something else mid-season. But I hope that we see a lot of the youth with the ball in their hands in Brooklyn, rather than like MPJ, high volume MPJ, just to see what that looks like. Cause I don't think it's going to be pretty. I want to see everything else on that team besides that.
No, understood. And like, to be clear, I'm not making the case that he should be like running 20 ball screens just a game or anything like that. Just kind of looking at the Denver Nuggets, the Denver numbers. He hasn't had a season with, you know, fewer than 70% of his twos being assisted on since his rookie season.
Crazy.
Like every year since the rookie, and even that was 63%. So 71%, 70, 75, 76, 74. Just to speak to like him getting those cuts and things like that. And then obviously that very high percentage of his threes have been assisted on. So like for me, it's just like, okay, he's now in a context to where the twos might drop from 70 to like 62. What does that look like? What do the self-created reps look like more than we want him to have a whole bunch of on-ball use?
Totally. Well, Nikias, appreciate you joining me today, man. I'm fired up to have you with Yahoo Sports, man. You'll be covering the WNBA Finals starting Friday, Aces and Mercury. Boy, like, kind of crazy. The Fever went so far with all the injuries they had.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be exciting. Starting Friday is game one, right? Mm-hmm. That's in Las Vegas.
Yes.
Will you be traveling for the W Finals at all? Or I know you'll be covering it on the pod, of course.
I will indeed be traveling. I'm actually waiting to see like what the practice schedule is going to be, so I know if I need to fly in, or just knowing when to fly in. But I will be covering it. So I'm excited to get to cover the first 7-game final series in W history. So this is cool. But yeah, just incredible resolve from this Fever group amongst all the injuries that they had to deal with. This has been a tremendous season for the Phoenix Mercury. Naturally, the Aces were literally under 500 midway through the year, and they reel off 16 straight wins to close out the regular season and get the 2 seed. they have now made this finals run. I'm just amped for this one. Asia Wilson, Alyssa Thomas, Duke, this is going to be good stuff. We're going to preview the finals on the next episode of the Dunker Spot. So if you are trying to get into the W or already a W fan, check out that episode. But I am amped for this finals, and I'm glad that I'm going to get to cover it in person.
Excited to have you on my team, Nikias. Look forward to listening to your pod with you and Steve. Appreciate you joining me today, man. Thank you.
Likewise, man. Appreciate you.
Coming up next, we got Joel Smith from Yahoo Fantasy Football with my 6 points from this week in the NFL. All right, now time for 6 points with Yahoo Sports fantasy football expert Joel Smith. Joel, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. I don't know if I classify myself as an expert, but I'll take it.
I feel the same way. Anytime someone says NBA expert, I'm like, I'm not an expert. I'm just an analyst. But you are definitely one of the people with the most expertise covering fantasy football right now. So I appreciate you joining me today, Joel. Let's start off with number one from the weekend. Lamar Jackson injured, likely out multiple weeks now. The Ravens also lose that game. They fall to 1-3 at this point. From a non-fantasy standpoint, just to start off here, how much trouble are the Ravens in at this point? Because Lamar's hurt. They've got a ton of injuries on defense. It feels like danger zone here for Baltimore.
Yeah. I am worried, even for Lamar, it being a hamstring injury is really tough. Because if you have a hamstring injury for like Matthew Stafford, it's not as big of a deal. But obviously, it affects Lamar a little bit more. So that bye week does help him out. So they'll have 2 weeks where he'll probably sit out, and then they'll have the bye. So I'm guessing he'll come back after that. And the division's definitely helping him out. The Browns and Bengals aren't doing too much. I don't really have too much faith in the Steelers. They'll probably do their normal 9-8 season is what I would guess. But I still have faith in the Ravens making the playoffs, at least maybe not being that number one seed, obviously, this year. But I'm not too panicked yet.
I mean, look, I think with Lamar, the injury, concerning, obviously. But also, the performance in that game, he had the interception, bonehead decision, he had the fumble. And this is now 3 years in a row in big games. The 2023 AFC Championship game against the Chiefs, he had an interception, had a fumble. The 2024 AFC Divisional game against the Bills, he had an interception, he had a fumble. And then last week against the Chiefs, he has an interception, he has a fumble. And with Lamar Jackson, you know, I've been very open on this podcast about how this is my first year really getting back into the NFL, watching 9 hours every single Sunday. But I have watched the playoffs over the last handful of years. And for me, in my eyes, I've watched Lamar Jackson choke away some of these games. And this is after regular seasons in which he was dominant. I did not watch regular seasons closely at all, but he has choked and had some really underwhelming postseason performances. And I can't help but wonder, is Lamar Jackson just a big game choker with some of these games that he has? It feels like a trend to me, Joel. Tell me, like, am I wrong here? Because I feel like everybody says, no. That's not the case. Like Ben Solak, I had him on before the season. He's like, no, I still believe in Lamar. Feels like there's a lot of belief in Lamar, but I'm just seeing what I'm seeing. And I'm seeing, you know, silly decisions in big moments against the best teams. And a lot of carelessness in these games, which is different than what you see with 40-plus touchdowns and 4 interceptions last year. It's just dramatically different. So tell me, like, what's the truth for Lamar? Is he a big-game choker?
I would say it's somewhere in the middle. I definitely wouldn't say he's a big-game choker, because even, like, we look at Buffalo a couple weeks ago. They put up, like, 40 points. Like, I don't really blame that game on him. Baltimore's defense is 32nd in the NFL right now, so I don't think that helps him for sure. In some of those big games, they are against really good defenses, especially like the coaching in Kansas City. So we go back to like that defense in 2023. That's a really tough defense to go against. So yeah, he had those turnovers. You don't want to see that, especially from like that MVP level quarterback. But I wouldn't fully put the blame on Lamar. And he's also had that like playoff games where he has stepped up. And I think he's kind of broken that narrative a little bit because he didn't have a playoff win for a while. Now he at least has a few under his belt to help him out a little bit. So I don't think it's fully on him. I just think he hasn't really risen to the occasion to like the full extent like some of these other guys. Like we've seen that playoff run from Burrow. We've seen it multiple times from Patrick Mahomes. But a lot of these other quarterbacks, we haven't really seen it. Like even Josh Allen to extent hasn't made the Super Bowl yet. Justin Herbert like hasn't made it all the way through that. So I think Lamar Jackson, he has a little bit more pressure given that he's been the multi-time MVP. but I wouldn't fully put the blame on him here.
I think it's fair. I think we've also seen throughout history playoff chokers. Peyton Manning at one point was a choker, and then he wins. Alex Rodriguez in baseball was a choker, and then he has a dominant run to the World Series with the Yankees, and it was really one of his only great playoff postseasons, for what it's worth, but he did win a World Series. So, like, we've seen these guys across sports that are quote-unquote chokers, and then they win. And so I think there's still a chance of that with Lamar, but the hamstring injury, the amount of injuries that this team has overall on their roster, and the fact that it's a hammy as well is concerning. So pivoting to fantasy football here, with Lamar's absence, how do you expect this to impact, you know, Flowers offensively, Henry in the backfield as well? Because I would imagine from my perspective that it's going to hurt in the short term, but if I have these guys on my team, I'm thinking more about selling, considering the concern about re-injury to Lamar's hamstring, that their value significantly drops. Would it be a panic decision for me if I have Henry or Flowers on my team to try to trade them now? Or do you think that could indeed be actually a wise decision in the long term?
I actually would agree with you in terms of, I don't think it's a panic. For four games into the season, we actually kind of have like pretty strong correlation in terms of how the season is going to go. If your guy has not performed for four straight weeks, there's not as much of a chance. Where in week one, we're like, hey, it's not that big of a deal. Let's calm down. But at this point, if you are 1-3, 0-4, even 2-2 for some teams, like I would be more on the sell side. If you're winning, I don't mind buying. But I do think it affects this team a lot. Like I think Lamar Jackson, people don't fully get how much he affects this running game for the running back. So a stat that I love saying, the past 6 years, who has led the NFL in yards per carry four times? It's not Derrick Henry. It's the Baltimore running back. Whoever's the starting running back for Baltimore for the last six seasons. So like Derrick Henry last year, yeah. But like J.K. Dobbins, Mark Ingram, like those type of guys where they're not the number one running back in the NFL, but they do it because of Lamar Jackson. He causes so much attention to be focused on him in that read option game, those design runs, where it opens up these lanes and that efficiency just skyrockets, but he's also not taking those going attempts. So we get that with like a Jalen Hurts, but he also has taken 10 goal line sneak touchdowns a year for the past few years. With Lamar, we don't really see that. So that efficiency blows up and then they get down to the 5 yard line in this incredible offense and they just hand it off to Derrick Henry every time. So that's the big worry, is this offensive line, too, isn't as great. So they have been helped out by Lamar Jackson. They're still first in yards before contact, but that is a Lamar Jackson stat. When we're actually looking at run block win rate, there's that stat. They were number three last year, but there was a bunch of offensive line changes this offseason for Baltimore. They're 14th. So it's not bad, but it's not elite anymore like it was last year. So then we add in Cooper Rush. And then what happens there with this rushing attack? So maybe a little bit more volume, hopefully, at least compared to what we've seen this year for Derrick Henry. But this defense isn't helping him out in terms of those game scripts and getting a bunch of carries in that second half. And Cooper Rush, like, how much is that efficiency going to fall off, both the offense but also this rushing attack? That's the main worry for me.
All right, number two question here of our 6 points here, Joel. Ties. 40-40 game between the Cowboys and the Packers. Why do we only have 10-minute quarters of these new rules, Joel? I don't get it. We should go to 15 or have sudden death. I just felt like I got blue balled in that game. It was an awesome game, and we ended in a tie. I stayed up late for that one, man. Come on.
Totally. The 40-40, I was thinking of the exact same thing. I feel blue balled after going 40-40 and we don't get to the end of that game with an actual decision. So the tie is, I don't know how much you watch college football. I think this is the one or two things where college football does a lot better. Overall, I'd say the NFL is a better product, but the overtime in college football is so good, in my opinion, at least how it used to be in terms of just every possession being from the 25. I don't know if I like the 2-point conversion thing, but 10 minutes too. Like if they're going to give both teams possession, why are we only making it 10 minutes instead of like, if anything, making it longer if we're going to get both teams possession? They're asking for ties at that point.
Well, related to this game, the Packers in this game, they tie 40-40. They're now 2-1-1 on the season after losing week 3 to Cleveland, pretty disgusting loss. And then they tied to Dallas. No Tech Ben over on X. My friend Ben Thompson runs the best tech blog out there for techery. He's very level-headed when it comes to tech, but he is unhinged when it comes to the Milwaukee Bucks and the Green Bay Packers. And he posted a tweet saying, just utterly unacceptable from Matt LaFleur. Atrocious. Didn't go for it at midfield. Risked it with 15 seconds left in the half. Horrible conservative play calling. Awful time management at end. Special teams sucked. I'm out. And I quoted that and I said, all true. It didn't go for the win at the end of the fourth quarter. Hard to view the Packers as a serious contender with LaFleur as head coach. And the replies I got to that were interesting. On one hand, there were people saying, stick to basketball. There are other people saying, you're overreacting here to one game. The Packers offense would be nowhere near as good as it is without LaFleur. And then there were a lot of Packers fans saying, you're right. He is the guy holding us back from reaching our true potential. One of the replies was like, why are we not unleashing Matthew Golden even more? Like, there was like some replies like that saying, people talk about the offense. We can do more with Golden. Was one of the responses. So where do you align with Matt LaFleur here with his impact on the Packers? Am I in the right? Is Ben Thompson in the right to be overly critical? Or do you tend to side on the end of, no, he's good. Let's just chill here.
I'm overall pro Matt LaFleur. Okay. I think it is very real, especially like you tell you, this wasn't just that one game in terms of play calling. So I get it from Packers fans, like this has happened multiple times and it was pretty bad, like in terms of their conservative play calling, it's like awful. No one wants that 40-40 tie, but they like wasted a lot of time. But with that being said, he is so good at so many other things and there's no perfect coach in the NFL. And he's still like somewhat young, you know, but also like the coaches in the NFL, like even the best of the best have had bad moments. And when we're talking about Super Bowl success, not to go back to college football, but it's kind of the thing, like they can't do it until they do. Like the last 5 years, we've seen it multiple times. Like Kirby Smart couldn't do it. Jim Harbaugh couldn't do it. Ryan Day couldn't do it. And then they did it and everyone stops talking about it. And I can kind of predict that with Matt LaFleur because he's so good at so many different areas. They've been to the playoffs 5 times since he's been hired in 2019. So 6 seasons, he's been to the playoffs 5 times. Since that span, only 3 other coaches have done that with a team. Andy Reid, John Harbaugh, and then Sean McDermott in Buffalo. So it's like the company that he's in, like it's hard to complain. And they have a great team, but I also wouldn't say it's a super team. Like the defense after the first 2 weeks looked incredible. Everyone kind of had them as those Super Bowl favorites after 2 weeks. But the fact of the matter is those pass catchers, I would say, are below average in terms of a full group. The offensive line is definitely below average, leaning toward bad. So there's definitely some flaws in this what is overall a great team. And Matthew Golden, I have some other opinions, but yeah.
With Matthew Golden, what are those other opinions?
Yeah, well, I think it's hard to ask too much of a rookie, especially like him. And I get he's a first-round pick. They want to use him more. But he has been playing. So I don't think it's one of those things like Trevion Henderson in New England. I understand that more, the complaints about it, because he's not on the field a lot. Golden is still playing a lot. He's just not getting the targets, which a lot of that does fall on receivers. And that was kind of one of his weaknesses in college. So I don't think it's more of a coaching thing. Like you can try to get him more involved in areas, but he's 4 games into his career. He's playing a lot. Like I think that more falls on Golden than coaching right now.
All right, number 3, AJ Brown. He's definitely not happy. It feels like he's on the verge of a total meltdown here, even though the Eagles are 4-0 and they have a chance to defend and go win another Super Bowl. AJ Brown, not happy because currently he's on pace for only 59 catches, 642 yards, and 4 touchdowns if he plays all 17 games this year with the Eagles, because it has been a really strange start to the year for him. Aside from one big game, it's been 3 games where he's been a non-factor. What's the deal with AJ Brown, Joel? Is he in the right to be feeling a certain way about this, or do you see a light at the end of the tunnel for him?
It is strange. That is the perfect word for it, I would say. So anytime that I look into these type of stats, especially the player struggling, like I want to go watch it too. So I went and watched his whole week 4. And it's interesting because, like, you know, I think he kind of has the right to complain about some things. But the targets are there, even in the low passing offense. Because I think people are like, oh, they're not passing the ball. That's why he's not doing well. Week 1, yeah, he is top 10 in target share. He has 8 targets in 3 straight games. So what's wrong. The offense is the main thing. It's a lot different this year. They obviously lost their offense coordinator, and A.J. Brown right now, he's getting less work in the slot in general. Like, he's playing basically more outside than anybody in the NFL. Like, he's pretty one-dimensional right now in this offense, and their play action has dropped a decent bit. Their motion has dropped a little bit as well, and the running game isn't as strong. So I feel like that all kind of comes together and forms a lot of different problems. When they don't have that super strong running attack and they're running less play action off on top of it, they're not really throwing him screens. They threw him his first one last week and it went for -2 yards. And everything else is just pretty stale. So his catch rate in 2024, how many times he was catching the ball when he was targeted? Was that 70%? That's pretty good. Hurts is pretty accurate. This year it's down to 52%. And it's not a huge drop off in terms of Hurts. It's more just when he's being targeted. So he had 8 or 9 targets last week. I looked at every single one. There wasn't one where it was like easy catch that didn't happen in terms of a missed throw or a drop or whatever. Like, it was contested targets downfield where it kind of seemed like they were just forcing him the ball. It wasn't very efficient. It's a lot of hitch routes on the outside and deep balls, and nothing is just easy for him. So it's kind of like I compare it to Marvin Harrison in Arizona or like George Pickens in Pittsburgh last year. It's kind of what it was looking like compared to how it was for A.J. Brown last year. So I have hope in things changing. Like, we saw that week 3, it can work in those big games, but I think he's just going to be a lot more boom bust this year, which is tough for your, what, second round pick?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, for a second round pick. So in other words, it feels like you're saying if you still have him on your team and if there's somebody in your league that wants to pay what feels like fair value for him, you're selling A.J. Brown.
I would lean that way for sure. I just don't love having players in fantasy that kill your week. Like, Yahoo posts that social media graphic every week of like, hey, here's the number one guy in the week that lost you your week if you played him. It's like David Montgomery scoring 1 point this week. And I feel like A.J. Brown is going to be on that a lot this year. It can be on the opposite end and win you a decent amount. But I feel like there's going to be some more weeks ahead that are like this.
Yeah, I did not draft him. I had the 12th pick in my keeper league. And I was like, I'm not taking him at the swing. Just feels like too volatile of a situation. And even more volatile than I expected. And for the Eagles, it's just kind of funny. Like, you win a Super Bowl, you're 4-0, you're undefeated right now. It feels like in some ways this team has a real chance to win it all again. And yet you have your receiver, your star receiver, posting cryptic messages.
Yeah, they're 4-0. It's actually crazy, yeah. Yeah, it's a situation where, like, not that it could only go down, but it can only go down if the volume stays the same. He was number one in efficiency last year. I think he was the wide receiver 12 in fantasy just because that volume was lower. So that was the hope this year, was like, oh, can his volume increase and that efficiency stay number one? And it's actually been the opposite. The volume is still really low as a team, and that efficiency has just plummeted for all the following reasons that I said.
All right, number 4, Tyreek Hill suffered a traumatic major knee injury, dislocated knee, torn ACL, et cetera, et cetera. So he's out for the year. This could also change the trajectory of his entire career. Tell me, from a fantasy perspective, Joel, can you rank the Dolphins' fantasy beneficiaries? Like, who's going to benefit the most here with the Tyreek Hill absence?
Yeah, I think number one is clear. The other ones are a little bit more interesting. Number one, I would say Jalen Waddle. We don't have much in terms of him playing without Tyreek Hill outside of his rookie year, which he was incredible as a rookie. But there is one game. It was in the fantasy playoffs in 2023, I believe the first round. He had 8 receptions, 142 yards, and a touchdown in the one game without Tyreek Hill since he was traded to Miami. So that is obviously a really good sign. When he's just playing on the field without Tyreek Hill in the games where they're both in there, but Tyreek Hill's on the sideline on a passing play, that target share has jumped up 8%. So it's about 20% with him on the field, 28% without. That would equal about 8 targets a game. That'd be plenty for Waddle. The big thing is just his efficiency. When Tyreek Hill is not out there, he has a 2.8 yards per route. That would be number 4 in the NFL this year behind Puka, JSN, and Tyreek Hill. So basically number 3 in a way. So overall, I'd say he's the number 1 benefactor.
Okay, so Waddle number 1. What about behind him? We see Darren Waller play his first game of the season. He had a big week. Malik Washington seems to be a very popular waiver target this week. Do you expect, is it murky with those guys? Or do you have any level of confidence or who's like second behind Waddle?
Yeah, murky is definitely the right word. I wouldn't say confidence is the word that I'm preaching, but I would go Malik Washington. Darren Waller, I don't want to put my faith in a 33-year-old tight end that's just coming back. He had 14 snaps, so he had 2 touchdowns. That's awesome. He only played 14 plays. Malik Washington, I would say, benefits more for him his direct role. He only got 1 of the 9 targets after Tyreek Hill left the field. So that's why the confidence isn't too high. But in terms of the screens, that's the really interesting thing in Miami, especially if they can't run the ball. And I think Tyreek Hill affects that a little bit in how he separates the field, giving them a little less space in this Miami running game. So they go to the screens, is what Mike McDaniel does. Last year, that was Achan and it was Jonnu Smith, number one among running backs, number one among tight ends. This year, I was looking after 4 weeks and I couldn't find the screens. They were nowhere to be found. Tyreek Hill wasn't really getting them back. Waddle had 1. Achan was only at 3, which is really low for him. And Darren Waller didn't get any. And I looked up Malik Washington and he had 5, which was definitely the most on the team. So if that can increase, it can be beneficial in those PPR leagues. He's only running about 60% of routes right now, so that'll go up without Tyreek Hill. He's that main slot guy, very short targets. So hopefully in those PPR leagues, he can get enough volume where he can maybe be a flex, matchup-dependent guy.
All right, number 5 here of our 6 points, Woody Marks. I drafted him. I'm feeling good. He had a big game off my bench last week. I'll be starting him this week. 2 touchdowns on the day in his breakout against the horrible Titans. But is he a league winner? Do you think, Joel? Is Woody Marks a league winner?
I don't think league winner is what I would title him as. I think he's a solid start this week because of the matchup, and I think that's kind of how it'll be going forward. He has RB2 potential. The big thing for me is Houston's averaging 16 points per game right now. The offensive line is not the greatest. So last week, yeah, he had 58% of the touches, but that equaled 21 touches, and they won 26-0 against the Titans. So that's I think his best game of the season maybe is when he does get that Titans matchup and they'll play him again. So maybe he'll have the opportunity again down the line. I think his touches will increase in terms of that percentage, that 58, maybe it gets to 65 to 70%. So that can be good. He is first in fantasy points per touch. So he's been ultra efficient when he has gotten the ball this year. And it's not a really low, he had 35 touches so far. So it's not nothing. But I think that he is definitely going to go as his offense does, and that's what scares me, because where's my confidence level in terms of this Houston offense? It's not as great. So this week, he gets Baltimore. No Lamar Jackson helps that game script. Maybe they can get something going. Baltimore's 32nd against running backs. So I don't mind him at all this week, but I think there is going to be some weeks ahead where it's a little tough at times.
Yeah, I think that's very fair with him. I mean, personally, I'm hoping that he has some really good weeks where I'm able to flip him into something better at some point with Woody Marks. Otherwise, I think this Texans offense is just so bad. You're not going to feel a lot of confidence in touchdowns. You'll be hoping in fourth quarters and garbage time situations, run the ball, pass the ball to Marks. And I just don't like feeling that way in fantasy. I like being invested in the players that are ahead in the winning teams that score a lot week to week, rather than some of these bad teams with players that you're just hoping for volume and garbage time points tallying up. On to number 6 here, Jameson Williams. He was a really good wide receiver last year for the Lions, 1,001 yards on 58 catches in 15 games last year. Through 4 games this year, only 214 yards on 10 catches. Is Jameson Williams a buy low, or are you avoiding him?
Kevin, this was actually the one that I was most excited to talk about. I would say he's a buy low for week 5, especially if you're losing. I don't mind buying him right now because I think it'll get better. And that week 5 matchup against the Bengals is kind of the perfect spot to do it. Like I was talking about with AJ Brown earlier, a lot of these times when they have these really rough games, I was like, all right, I need to go watch every single play and see what happened. And I went and watched his 8 targets this week. Here's how it went, if I can brief you on these 8 targets. It was a completed hitch route, really short route. Goff got hit on what would have been a 50-yard touchdown in a post. There was a go route that was deep, that was slightly underthrown and dropped. It was a corner that went nowhere. Another deep post that Goff got picked under pressure. It was another slot fade that could have gone for a touchdown, but it was a touched overthrown. It was a dropped crosser and then a 25-yard crosser over the middle. So it was all things where it wasn't like it was these deep contested catches going nowhere for the most of the time or not really valuable targets. It was all really, really close from being huge plays. And it's a little different in how they are using him. Last year, his average depth of target was 12 yards downfield. That's probably like top 25-20% in terms of how long you're throwing downfield to a guy on average. They talked about how they do every single offseason, it seems like. Hey, we're going to use Jameson Williams as a more all-around receiver, use him in all different sort of ways. They've used him creatively downfield, but his average depth of target this year is not 12, it is 21. So they are not throwing it short to him at all. But instead of just running him on straight go routes every single time, they are using him very creatively downfield. So it is very interesting. Like, he has those deep crossers. He has those fades out of the slot. He has lots of play action. He has those deep digs. Like, a lot of really valuable targets here where I think on days where it does hit, it's going to hit big. And we look at this Bengals team, it's not looking too good. And the Lions, more than anybody, run up the score. I was playing Amon-Ra St. Brown, I think last 2 weeks ago against Chicago, and the score was like 38-14. And I'm like, Amon-Ra is like 20 fantasy points, but at least they're up by 24 now. They'll be done scoring. And then they have another touchdown to Amon-Ra St. Brown, and then another touchdown to Amon-Ra St. Brown. Like, it's not even that they're running up the score, they're throwing up the score. So that's where it's like Jameson Williams against this Bengals matchup. I think the volume is still going to be there, and there's going to be tons of opportunity here against a team that is six worst against receivers, six worst against the outside, and they have that number one pass protection advantage. So against a Browns team where he basically missed out on two touchdowns because of the pressure, it's not going to be the same against Cincinnati, I would say.
I did notice that last week he had a league-high 210 air yards, which hits on your point about average depth of target for him this season. I think as soon as we get off this podcast, I'm going to try to trade for him because I could use a receiver.
I'm confident in this week. For this week, I love him.
All right, let's go for two here with our 6 points here with two more questions for you. Speaking about trade targets, who are some trade targets if you're an 0-4 team right now in fantasy football?
Yeah, first off, I'm sorry. Tough place to be, but there's still some hope. You got like a 15-20% playoff chance. A lot of it just comes down to the work. So there's been lots of injuries. How do we counter that? I would say the first group of players would be the guys that values are probably going to decrease. So you're buying them to win now. This would be your Jake Fergusons, your George Pickens, your Xavier Worthies. Will those still have value long-term? It's not like you're trading a guy for 2 weeks. However, for these next 2-3 weeks, they're going to be really good, you're hoping for. So I like trading for them. I like trading for guys that maybe have that higher injury risk, which sounds a little backwards, but for guys that are 4-0, maybe trading away Chris Olave, J.K. Dobbins, and Keenan Allen, those type of players to these teams that are 0-4. Because Chris Olave, I don't necessarily love him long term because he's just constantly hurt. There's lots going on. But for right now, he's producing really well. So I don't mind him if you're 0-4. Or good guys that are like a good chance of being at their best currently. J.K. Dobbins, another one, like doubling down that injury risk, but he's also maybe at his best right now as R.J. Harvey kind of comes on a little bit. Same with Travis Etienne, maybe Alvin Kamara, with those other running backs that maybe later on in the season they're taking more work.
All right, number 8. Who are some trade targets for the very fortunate and lucky and blessed 4-0 teams?
Yeah, I think you got to take advantage. This isn't the time where you coast, like you kind of go foot to the pedal right here. So buying, if you're winning, a lot of it is those injured players. So we talked about Derrick Henry earlier. Maybe Bucky Irving falls on this, depending on how that comes out. Like Lamar Jackson, Brock Bowers even, CeeDee Lamb, George Kittle, Rashee Rice, who's suspended. I think that is all great guys that long-term, they're going to be better than what they are right now when a lot of them aren't able to be played. The same thing with like bye weeks. Lots of week 5 bye weeks, some really good players like Josh Jacobs, Rome Odunze, Drake London. I think they're all solid trade targets. And then the last category is the ones where you're kind of banking on the talent. I don't want to be playing Brian Thomas Jr. right now. I don't want to be playing Ladd McConkey. Part of me doesn't even want to be playing Ja'Marr Chase. But like those guys, A.J. Brown even maybe,
that's crazy.
Or no.
Three of the top 24 picks in every draft.
Yeah. So all of them, like, you can maybe buy Ja'Marr Chase and hope they trade for a different quarterback. You can buy Brian Thomas and hope that he turns it around. You can buy Ladd McConkey and maybe Keenan Allen goes down to injury or has another hamstring.
McConkey is getting some targets. What is he, seven, eight targets a game for McConkey? He's still getting targets.
Yeah. He doesn't have a role that I love, but he is second in the NFL in routes run. Still getting targets. He's had some drops. So it's not like he's just not playing or not being used at all. There's still some hope there. So that's the guys where it's like, yeah, you don't love playing him in week five, but they're a round two pick. Maybe they turn it around and then you have a round two pick in the fantasy playoffs. And that's kind of the focus here. Not that we're playing for the fantasy playoffs yet, but we're playing for the second half of the season, I would say.
If you're a team in a league with it, let's just say, you know, you're seeing the news this morning, Dylan Gabriel named starting quarterback at the Cleveland Browns. Obviously, he's just a rookie. Big questions there. If you're in a league where, like, let's just say Isaiah Bond, who is a popular wide receiver waiver pickup this week, and he's still sitting on waivers, are you going after him if you're 4-0 or 0-4 as an upside guy, or is the Dylan Gabriel news making you just avoid entirely Isaiah Bond as an example?
I don't know if I would necessarily put it as like a 4-0 or 0-4 decision. It just kind of depends on your bench. What I wouldn't do is I wouldn't start him this week. I don't, like, maybe Judkins, maybe. But I cannot confidently start any Brown this week. Dylan Gabriel, I think it's cruel that they make his first start against Brian Flores, like specifically against young quarterbacks. Like, it's just usually not a recipe for success. So I actually did pick up Isaiah Bond in my main league, which is a dynasty league. So I like him for like dynasty. He's been getting targets. Cedric Tillman is now on IR, so that playing time will get another bump. But for week five, wouldn't start him. Long-term stash, I don't mind it. I think there's some potential there. And the Browns have been known to go very pass heavy at times. So if they do have a situation where it is somewhat efficient, maybe average, that volume can be very valuable.
In my number one league with my high school friends, I'm 1-3 with the second most points in the league.
Happens.
In eighth place, eight playoff teams. So I still, you know, there's a lot of teams that make the playoffs in our league. And I picked up Bond and Breshard Smith. So two kind of swings to have on my bench. Young swings hoping for an increased role over the course of the season. And Keandre Miller, too. I kind of went 3-for-3 with my hopes and waivers this week, spending some of that waiver money. But ultimately, I mean, I think for some of these teams, like some of these 0-4 teams, like I've, you know, different type of league. I'm 1-3, eight playoff teams. Most leagues, I don't think, have eight playoff teams. That's a lot. But for these teams, it is the type of thing where you gotta make moves. Like in my league, I think a lot of people are hesitant to make moves. They just kind of sit on their teams that they draft. It's a very low activity league when it comes to trades. But if you're in a league where people love to trade, like you gotta take swings, man. You have to, and you have to invest in the now. Because what is the average league, Joel? Like four teams make the playoffs, you'd say, or six teams make the playoffs?
I really like six. Eight. My ideal is 12 team leagues and six make the playoffs. That's what I'd say is my favorite.
Eight is a loss. Like, that's ridiculous. It feels like the training wheels are on in my league. It's ridiculous. And it's PPR. PPR, this is my first time playing full PPR. PPR just feels fake to me. It's too much. Half PPR is the way, in my opinion. That's just, you know, is what it is.
Yeah, my league is the opposite in terms of trades. They will trade just because they're bored. I don't even know if they're trying to be productive at some points. They just want to have fun and they'll just make trades because they have nothing to do that day. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't, but it's fun.
That's my type of league, but you know, is what it is. Joel, thank you so much for joining me today, man.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Loved it.
Big thank you to Nikias and Joel for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to Emmy for producing today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. Thanks to you for giving us a listen. We'll be back again next Monday, because that's going to be our schedule moving forward. Monday and Thursdays, you're going to hear my podcast starting next week, every week this NBA season, plus some special episodes, I'm sure, in the weeks and months ahead. So stay tuned. Next Monday, we'll be back again with more NBA talk. Have a good weekend, everybody.